Okay, all of us know one of the dyed-in-the-wool type rock-ribbed, born and bred card-carrying feminists. Now, what I'm going to say here does not apply to my guest in this hour, Sarin Foster. She is from Feminists for Life, and there's a difference here. I'll let her explain that a little later in the conversation, but we do know women or men like this for whom, say, abortion is an article of faith. It is the fundamentalist, the most fundamental human right. It is something that cannot be touched. It is the right before which all other rights, all other considerations must bow. We know people like this. And if you're going to broach the subject of abortion, sometimes you think twice. How am I going to talk to, I mean, I can talk to someone who's on the fence, or I can talk to someone who's in my camp, who's pro-life. But to talk to a feminist about abortion, how do you respond to their objections? They're trained to offer objections when you put forth the view that abortion is wrong. How do you deal with it? We're going to spend this hour talking with Sarin Foster, president of Feminists for Life, based in Washington, D.C., about how to discuss abortion with a feminist. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Sarin, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for having me again on your show.
Hi, Sarah. Well, first, I understand that you testified yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee. What was the subject?
The subject was the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. It's a law that has been also named the Casey and the Connor and Lacey law, and it would say that a second victim, an unborn child who is killed in the case of both a pregnant woman and her baby being killed, or in the case of a woman who was assaulted and lost her child, that there could be a murder charge brought about against the perpetrator of the crime. And it was it's something that you can go to our website at feministforlife.org and get a link to C-SPAN and watch it if you missed it on C-SPAN yesterday. So we are very pleased to, you know, be one of the groups that refuses to choose between women and children and say we support both women and children and through legal protection and oppose all forms of violence. And this bill, is going to have widespread support. 84% to 87% of the country supports the idea that a prosecutor would be able to bring about charges against a person who killed an unborn child. And I think that's a real testament to, you know, Americans on both sides of the abortion debate, that they're getting the fact that this is a living, human, breathing person, and that there should be protection, you know, regardless of one's personal position on abortion. More and more pro-choice people are seeing that there are reasons why an unborn child should be protected.
You gave your testimony. What kind of questions were put to you during the testimony there before the House Judiciary Committee?
Well, most of the questions were asked of the attorney, Jerry Bradley from Notre Dame. One of the comments that I made was criticizing the alternative bill, the so-called single victim substitute, where abortion advocates have put together a bill called the Motherhood Protection Act. And in it, there's no mention of mother of whom. And all it talks about is more severe penalties for a woman who is killed who's pregnant, and if the pregnancy is interrupted. And I sort of mock the term interruption, because a pregnancy is never going to start up again. And so they've chosen these words very carefully, and I thought it was fairly insincere that they're talking about a pregnancy being interrupted, and then they talk about a pregnancy being terminated. And Mr. Nadler from New York challenged me on this point, and I said, well, if you're going to talk about a person being terminated, that's a different thing. A pregnancy can actually be terminated by a live and happy birth. It just doesn't have to end in an abortion or a miscarriage. So I really am concerned about the fact that they're trying to make this out that it's only the woman who's being affected. And it's actually women who have gone through this experience, who have been assaulted, who have lost their children or a child through violence, that are saying that they want legal justice. They want the legal system to be able to prosecute someone who took away the life of their unborn child. there was a case 10 or 11 days ago of a woman who had was carrying twins. She was in her ninth month. Her 57-year-old boyfriend beat her in the abdomen repeatedly, and she went through labor and delivered stillborn twins. And the question that I posed to Congress was, is this a case of one victim, or were there three? In the case of Lacey and Connor Peterson, was there one victim or two? And in the case of this woman named Tracy Marciniak, who had a baby boy named Zachariah, in the eyes of the law, there was no victim who died. And, you know, she was at the end of her pregnancy about to give birth, and she was beaten in her abdomen, and her baby died of blunt force trauma. So what we're saying is that this is a real human being here. This child should have been protected there, but since he is or she was killed, that the perpetrator should be tried for killing this child.
Now, that's obviously an issue that is very contested there in Washington still. Let's talk about kind of down in the grassroots where the average person, our average listener, is going to find themselves talking with someone that they know for whom abortion is a very important issue, but they are the typical feminist position on this, and they're going to consider abortion rights to be fundamental rights, especially for women. Where do you begin in broaching the subject with a feminist on the issue of abortion?
I think we always go back to what is best for women. And when we start peeling away the rhetoric and the anger, I mean, first of all, I try to get in the mindset that we have to understand that a lot of these women have never known a day without legal abortion. And they think we're taking away a right that they have. And while you and I know that we have a right to life and there's no real right to take away the life of another unborn child, these women are very defensive. Many of them have had abortions themselves, and so we have to be particularly sensitive and put ourselves in their place. What would it be like to live in the world where there was never a day without legalized abortion? Maybe you've had an abortion because your family thought it was a great idea and it was the best thing for you when you got pregnant. And so we start with that premise and then go back to what was the original problem? What is the reason why a woman might have an abortion? And we systematically eliminate the reasons why women are driven to abortion, giving them really great alternatives. And by not underestimating women, by believing in women and the power of women and the ability of women to challenge difficult situations and come out on the other side, and also believing in our community and that there are good people out there, perfect strangers who will come through for her when maybe her family or her boyfriend or husband may have let her down, and try to talk about connecting her to resources and then challenge them to help participate in looking for other resources, unmet needs. If there are things that they're seeing in their community that are unmet, redirecting their energy towards things that will help give women the rest of the choices. And by that I mean, you know, that includes marital parenthood. That includes adoption options. People who have seen people struggle through single parenthood, what we might do to help them in terms of housing, daycare, maternity coverage on a college campus, workplace initiatives if they're, a mom, you know, who's got a job and maybe, you know, she's a single mom, never married or divorced, and doesn't have support, and maybe she's second-guessing abortion and saying that it should be a right to other people because this is too difficult. So it's always about going back to meeting her needs and understanding things from her point of view, and also understanding that a lot of men have been bullied into accepting abortion rights, and they've been told for too long that they don't have a right to this debate, and they do. That's what part of being an American is about. You have a right to free speech. You have a right to participate. And men are, you know, part of the solution. And we have to recognize that they can, you know, support women who have been pregnant. You know, they can contribute through policies, by speaking out, by working with their churches, et cetera, and so that they can be a really positive force. And every father who sets a great example and supports both the woman and the child, is helping to erode this kind of culture that says that if we can't solve a problem, we kill somebody. That's not what we do in America. I mean, we've got to raise expectations, especially to people in this next generation. So that's where we start.
We're talking with Sarah Ann Foster about how to discuss abortion with feminists. She's president of Feminists for Life, based in Washington, D.C. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Okay, this is one that I think probably is the most difficult to sort out, and that is when the feminist will immediately drive toward the exception that seeks to dictate the norm. That is, what about rape and incest? Surely you would allow an abortion in this case, wouldn't you? How do you respond?
Well, I think the way I respond to people is to first of all acknowledge the fact that they are trying, you know, it's a well-meaning attempt to support her, but they don't go far enough. And I think that establishing their intent is to support her is really important when you talk about rape and being sensitive to women who may have been sexually assaulted, you know, in the audience that you're talking to. I've done this a number of times, and I think the stories that we have about women who've been raped, children who've conceived in rape, and putting a name and a face on this is the most important thing that we can do, because we've been theorizing about this, and people have made an assumption that since she didn't do anything, this wasn't her fault, you know, why should she have to go through a pregnancy? So I start off talking about stories of women who have been assaulted, date rape situations, stranger rapes, and have found themselves pregnant afterwards and faced the decision and went on to have a child. People like Julie McAmaw, who was reunited with her mother 21 years after she was born and discovered that her father had raped her mother and that she was placed for adoption. And she asked her mom when she found out about this, she said, "Would it have been better if I was never born at all?" And her mother said, "You were the only good thing that came out of the rape." A story of a woman in one of the Michigan colleges that I visited who was listening to me. She looked like she was very upset during my speech. And she came up afterwards, and she had tattoos and piercings and multicolored hair. And I was sure she was going to get very angry with my response about rape. And she pulled me aside and said, "I was raped when I was 13 years old by my third cousin." And so here you have a situation of rape and incest. And she became pregnant. And her parents supported her and hid the pregnancy because in 48 states at that time, there was no protection from the rapist being able to stop an adoption. And she just said that she didn't want to talk about it publicly, but she has a semi-open relationship. She sees her son once a year. And she said, as a woman, okay, now this was a little kid when this happened to her. As a woman, I could not sit there and pass on the violence to my child that was done to me. And I thought that was really brilliant. And when I shared the story at Berkeley, a young woman stood up named Jackie and said, when I was 9 years old, she was an older student, a grad student, and one that had some disabilities. And she said that her mother had told her that she was conceived through rape, but in an angry moment had told her that if she had been conceived after Roe, that she would never have been born. And she looked at the pro-choice group of young women and men who were in the audience saying, "Yeah, what about rape? How could you be so cruel to her?" And she looked at them and said, "I have a right to be here." The room went wild, chills down my spine when I heard this. She put a face and a name, and they looked at her, and they said, "We didn't mean you." And she said, "Well, who did you think you meant?" And I think people don't understand the impact, the devastating impact that they have to people who have been conceived through sexual assault, that they give them this impression that they should be the exception. So one of the things I ask them is, you know, don't you think it's medieval that we would say that your worth is based on the way you were conceived? Should we stand people up and line them up and find out how your parents conceived you and decide what is better and what is worse and how your parents conceived you? I tell the students that you are valuable no matter who your parents are. And, you know, you are important, and you're never a reflection on your parents. You're important whether your father is in prison or your father's a person who's a big champion of peace or has just found the way to cure AIDS or whatever, that they're important no matter how they were conceived. And they start getting it. And one of the ways I think that we might convey, and has been, I think, fairly effective in terms of talking to students who really cannot connect, especially young men, about the violence of rape, is to envision 9/11 again and ask them, would there be any way that you could erase the memory of 9/11? But when especially well-meaning young men say that she should be able to have an abortion to erase the memory, is to for them to understand there is no way you can erase this memory. One young woman at Vanderbilt University who is at the med school there training to be a doctor stood up and told a young man in the audience who was trying to defend women who had been raped, who, quote-unquote, needed an abortion. She said, "I have to tell you, I was raped, and I had an abortion, and I want to assure you that the abortion was worse than the rape, and I regret it." So I think that these kind of stories and putting a face and a name on this is the most important thing that we can do, in addition to acknowledging their well-meaning intentions, and then sitting there redirecting their energies to what can we do to, number one, prevent sexual assault, on campus or wherever we're talking, and number two, what can we do to better serve them? And don't assume that women can't handle a pregnancy. Because Planned Parenthood and other abortion advocates have been talking about, pregnancies are only valued when everything is perfect and planned, there's this assumption that when everything doesn't go that way, that it's an awful experience. And for when people are at the beginning of a crisis, they need to remember other crises in their lives when they realize at the end of it that they learned something really valuable that enabled them to help other people in other difficult situations. And we can't, we're not going to go through life and never feel pain. These are growth experiences. Not that you wish this on anybody else, but when it happens to you, we buck up, we support each other unconditionally, and a woman who has been raped needs our unconditional support.
How should our listeners respond when discussing abortion with a feminist and the retort is, look, you are simply imposing your morality on me. You have no right to tell me or other women what we ought or ought not do?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you get a lot of this, that we're imposing our value on other people. I think we have to remember that as feminists, the basic tenets of feminism, and a lot of times people don't realize this, especially those in the younger, women's rights movement, the basic tenets of feminism are nonviolence, non-discrimination, and justice for all. So if you say you're a feminist, abortion is really incompatible with that, because abortion is discrimination based on age, size, location, sometimes gender, sometimes who somebody's parent is, or because a child in utero is determined to be disabled. And we also have to remind them that once she is pregnant, she is forever changed, no matter what the outcome, whether she gets married, she's a single mom, maybe a single fatherhood experience comes out of this, adoption, abortion, or miscarriage. A woman is forever changed, and what we need to do, if she's a feminist, and we are obviously pro-life feminists, 200 years of rich pro-life legacy that we continue today, that our values are woman-centered, and we need to refuse to choose between women and children and understand that women deserve better and that we should work together to get women better outcomes.
The average hypothetical woman who is considered by feminists often to be the prime candidate and the natural candidate for abortion is poor, perhaps no real relationship with their own parents, no support there, either emotionally or actually physically abandoned. Facing all the doors in her life that once stood open are going to be closed if this baby sticks around. How do you respond to that whole complex of issues that are usually presented with this kind of typical poster child for abortion?
Right. Well, a lot of times the students will say, well, what if she just doesn't want it? Because we try to break it down to what is it that she can't handle and what is it that she needs. But there's a young woman in our organization who placed a baby for adoption 6 years ago. Beautiful, well-educated young woman, and she's about to get married. Her, 6 years ago, she placed a baby boy for adoption, and we had an event recently where she went up to Congressman Chris Smith, a champion of women's rights as well as the right of the unborn to be born, and she told him about her adoption experience, and she said, we need to talk about adoption a lot more from the woman's point of view, from birth mother's point of view. Everybody talks about the benefits to the adoptees and the benefits to the adoptive parents, but what we're not conveying is that adoption is an empowering option for women. And I thought that was so beautifully stated, so that we have to remember that if she really doesn't feel able, really doesn't feel ready to be a mom, that we need to sit there and show her that there is a nonviolent alternative to abortion where she does not have to raise a child. Nobody is saying that she has to raise a child. There are 2 million families, vetted families out there waiting for a child to adopt. And so that we can accommodate her needs in a nonviolent way.
We're talking with Sarah Ann Foster, president of Feminists for Life. With only about a minute before we go to this break, Sarah Ann, how do you respond? Someone says, you could hardly call yourself a feminist. It sounds like you're against a woman's choice. You're against women.
Well, I think what they need to go back to is our feminist history and look at from Mary Wollstonecraft, who from Great Britain wrote Vindication of the Rights of Women and condemned neonatal infanticide and abortion. Look at Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, all of the great women's rights suffragists from the 1850s on, Alice Paul, the author of the Equal Rights Amendment, without known exception. They, too, refused to choose between women and children, and they worked in an uneasy alliance with others to make abortion illegal, and we're continuing their work by making it unthinkable.
And to the person who says, look, I guess I agree with you to a certain degree, but rather than make it unthinkable, let's just make it rare.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response?
Well, I think that's just not good enough. We have to make it both illegal and unthinkable. Illegal isn't enough because it may mean that you make it illegal, but women go to back alley butchers because they're desperate. Having resources without making it illegal won't make it unthinkable because people will still coerce some vulnerable women into having an abortion. We have to make it unthinkable through resources, support, education, advocacy, and legal protection for women as well as for the unborn so that they will not be coerced into an abortion.
How do you talk to a feminist about abortion? That's what we're discussing with Sarah Ann Foster, president of Feminists for Life, based in Washington, D.C. You can check out their website at feminists4life.org. It's all one word, feminists4life.org. Now, if you have a question or a comment, call during this break, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, you've heard this one before, and we'll see how Sarah responds. Look, we're really talking about an undeveloped, very primitive bunch of cells. How could you possibly invest in that dot? The same kind of rights that a woman has. Doesn't the woman's right outweigh? We'll find out after the break.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In recent church history, one of the church's most vocal advocates has also been one of the church's most vocal critics. He lived and worked in Germany during the Third Reich. He died in a Nazi prison camp, executed at the order of Adolf Hitler himself. He was Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips. Business tycoon Warren Buffett will no longer donate proceeds from his Berkshire Hathaway conglomerate to fund pro-abortion charities. The decision came after a group of stay-at-home moms petitioned Buffett, who happens to be one of the richest men in history. Steve Jordahl reports.
With an estimated fortune of $28 billion, Warren Buffett can afford to give away a lot of money. And he does, mostly to pro-abortion causes.
It was having a devastating effect on Pampered Chef's business. They were losing consultants and they were losing customers as a result.
Cindy Coughlin is a Pampered Chef consultant who was unhappy about her profits helping fund abortion. An article in Citizen magazine alerted other consultants who joined in protest.
I don't think God could have made this any louder or clearer. There are simply no excuses for the Christian community not to stand up and make their voices heard.
Buffett decided Berkshire Hathaway will no longer fund any charities, opting instead to let entities like Pampered Chef decide what charities to support. Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America.
Hooray for these ladies. What an incredible impact that they had on an empire. But it usually takes years and years of effort and is not always successful.
Wright says it's proof that good moral policy can be the basis of sound financial decisions.
These are ventures that are not only offensive to many, many people, but it does not make good business sense because he's doing away with the next generation of customers.
Warren Buffett and Pampered Chef declined to be interviewed for this story. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
It's estimated that Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Foundation gave $11 million in 2002 to organizations like Planned Parenthood. The article that helped change that is in the June edition of Focus on the Family's Citizen magazine. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Whining, food tantrums, bedwetting. Next time on Focus on the Family, psychologist Dr. James Dobson counsels parents of toddlers. Those moms and dads coping with their children's unlimited energy and rapid development. It's timely tips, it's reassurance, and it's practical assistance. Coming next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
What motivated Dietrich Bonhoeffer's classic writings, The Cost of Discipleship and Life Together? Find out with a book, Till the Night Be Past, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Till the Night Be Past is a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the Internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. Till the Night Be Past, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about how to discuss abortion with feminists. Saren Foster, president of Feminists for Life based in Washington, D.C., is our guest. If you'd like to join us, our number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, first-time callers, and Internet callers will get high priority. And since this is of a sensitive nature, we also encourage those who wish to call in anonymously. 1-800-730-2727. Saren, the contrast is often set up between the rights of the woman and the rights of the child, or in some cases it is simply described as a zygote or a blastocyst or by some technical term that seems to indicate it's something less than a human being. How do you answer the objection that certainly an adult woman's rights should outweigh what is essentially a clump of cells?
Well, this is a very common situation where, people are pitting women against children. And we refuse to choose between the two just as much as you would refuse to choose between a mother and a born child. You don't say in the normal course of life, well, this baby has less rights than this mother. People recognize that both have rights and they aren't incompatible. So we start there, but we've had a lot of these, you know, since we've started calling people zystoblasts and zygotes and embryos and fetuses lately, this is so irritating to a feminist who knows our history and that the early American feminists, those who were early doctors, some of the first female doctors in this country, that they talked about the fact that if women only knew about the glorious things that were going on inside of their bodies when they conceived a child, and as it grew until she delivered that baby, that there would never be an abortion. That if there would only be a window on the womb, and of course now with general, with the GE ads and all the Life magazines and things, people are starting to see that it is a baby and they're getting it. So the new way of dismissing this human life is by using, you know, medical terms or using a dead language, Latin, and calling an unborn child a fetus. And I don't know if you probably know this, but maybe some of your viewers don't, that fetus is a Latin word that means young child or young one. And I ask people to speak English. You know, this is not a tumor or a parasite that this woman is carrying. It is a young child or young one. And that these terms about zygotes and cystoblasts and embryo, et cetera, that they try to dehumanize people. And we've used this against other individuals, other groups of people throughout history to excuse ourselves and when we would perpetrate violence against a race or an ethnic group. And we know that this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. Yesterday, Mr. Nadler from New York, the congressman from New York, Jerry Nadler, was talking about zystoblasts and zygotes and how unfair it would be that we would... And I want to say that I am characterizing how he's saying this is not verbatim, but he was talking about a person who may assault a woman who's pregnant, and why should that person be charged with a second homicide or a murder in case she miscarries when it's just that early on? And I was remembering the time that I had a student come up to me after a speech, and he sat there and said, okay, so you believe that a couple of molecules, a speck, is a person, and that person should have rights. And I said, yes. And he said, and he starts talking about size. And I said, and I looked him up and down. I realized that I probably outweighed him, and I was taller than he was. And I looked at him. I said, so you believe that people should get rights according to size? And he's walking right into this. And I said, so this means I should have more rights than you. And everybody starts laughing. He's laughing. I mean, I wasn't doing it at his expense. I think it's ridiculous to line people up and say that you get more rights because you're a fully developed person, i.e. you're 18, or you're a fully developed baby. That this is something that we should celebrate, the spectrum of life, and especially for feminists who refuse to discriminate, to use violence, and believe in justice for all, that this is really incompatible to sit there and talk condescendingly about our own children in these kind of terms, and that understand that this is we have used misleading phrases like blobs of tissue and products of conception during the last 30 years in a way to make a human being less human, so that people can feel comfortable in taking away their rights and taking away their lives, and it's unacceptable. So we've just got to remember that if somebody started calling pregnant women a Latin term, gravidus, that we would get pretty mad. Feminists would get pretty mad if they referred to women in Latin terms and started talking about us as if we were a subject for a scientific experimentation.
It puts me in mind of something that a guest here on this program, Scott Klusendorf, has repeated several times on this program. He likes to quote from Abraham Lincoln with regard to the issue of slavery. Just to paraphrase, you know, Lincoln said, whatever rationale you use in order to deprive the black man of his rights can equally be used to deprive you, oh white man, of your rights. If it has to do with education, well, that means the next person you run into who's more educated than you can deprive you of your rights. If it has to do with physical ability, or if it has to do with sophistication, or it has to do with the color of skin, oh, their skin is darker, the next person who comes along who has lighter skin than you can deprive you of your rights. It seems the same logic you were employing with that student with regard to size.
Absolutely, and women in particular should be very careful about this because men outsize us. You know, they usually are bigger than we are. And so that would be a silly thing for us to do, is to say that somebody has less rights because they're smaller. You know, the other thing is that we have to remember that there's a very famous case, the Dred Scott case, is very, very famous, of course, about saying that black people don't have rights like white people. There's a lesser known case that was the case in Missouri years and years ago when Susan B. Anthony attempted to vote, and actually she did successfully vote. It was part of a larger campaign where she had women across the country going to attempt to vote, even though women didn't have the right to vote. And one woman was arrested, and it went all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Missouri Supreme Court at the time determined that women aren't persons. They do not have rights like those of a man. So we have to remember that we were discriminated against using the same kind of logic.
The person who says, look, okay, I understand your moral opposition to and your philosophical opposition to abortion, and in fact, I actually agree with you. I am personally opposed to abortion. However, I cannot see depriving anyone else of the right to choose. I can't see making it illegal. I can't see imposing that view on anyone else.
And the first thing I want to know is exactly who deserves to have an abortion from somebody like this. I mean, I've watched people, like there's a woman who's in charge of Republicans for Choice, and there's a number of Republicans, you know, pro-abortion Republicans or political figures who've been had this question asked to them, and they never come up with a good answer to it. Because, I mean, if it's not good enough for them, why is it good enough for a poor minority person, okay? And they sputter. There's no good answer to that. So I would answer that with another question. Who is this good enough for, and why don't they deserve better if you do?
This brings us back around to something that appears prominently in almost all the literature that Feminists for Life puts out, including the website. I take it is now the motto for Feminists for Life, which is simply, women deserve better. Explain that.
Well, for years now we have talked about the fact that there is a better way, that there are better outcomes for women, and there's been so much of this, you know, the focus has been, what about the baby on one side, and the other side says, what about the woman? And so we want to stop this conversation and say, okay, what about the woman? Doesn't she deserve better than being laid flat on her back, having somebody come at her with a sharp instrument or come at her with a poison pill and let her watch her own miscarriage after four treatments of RU-46? Shouldn't we be going back to the root causes that drive women to abortion? We believe abortion is a reflection that we have failed women, that women have settled for less, and it is up to women in particular to say, we're not going to put up with this anymore, and we're going to work together for better outcomes for women. And we're going to make men a part of the solution and not say that they're always part of a problem. So this campaign, which is, we have a number of partner organizations that you can find on the womendeservebetter.org website. People are participating individually. There are a number of other organizations, including Jennifer O'Neill and the Silent No More campaign of women who've had abortions. And people in California area, people across the country are talking about the fact that women deserve better than an abortion, and people are able to download placards for protest. They're able to get little stickers they can download and print their own stickers. There are talking points on partial birth abortion. My testimony on the Unborn Victims of Violence Act is up there so that they can take that sort of message to their legislators. And we've been meeting with a series of leaders on Capitol Hill, and we're going to continue to do that next week, Hill interns, Hill staffers, and bringing in the message that whatever they do in terms of abortion legislation, whether it's protection from abortion legally or better services and support for women, that they should always remember the woman when they're talking about abortion and not solely talk about the child, because both are involved in an abortion.
One simple objection that I think we all need to be able to answer is that we are if a woman cannot exercise reproductive choice, including abortion, then she no longer has the ability to control her own body or her own life. How do you respond?
Well, nobody has complete control over their own lives. This is a myth. I mean, this is some fantasy that's been perpetrated by Planned Parenthood, that everything has to be perfect and planned. there are lots of things that happen in our lives that we have no control over. And, of course, we try to, you know, that's being a human is about trying to control as many things as we possibly can. But we have to remember that once she is pregnant, the real question should be, what is the best possible nonviolent outcome for her? And that's what we have to work towards.
Are you proposing criminalizing or making criminals of women?
No, I think that, you know, we have to remember who takes advantage of her in this situation, who benefits. And I think that a lot of people don't ask the complementary question to this. Are you proposing criminalizing those around her who are not supporting her? And no, we're not seeing that either. I think that we need to make it illegal as a protection from her. And just like people would heavily penalize a drug dealer rather than the user, that we need to sit there and focus on those who benefit from a woman's misery and who are not there to support her. So that's where our focus would be. Although I have to also say that I do believe that women are capable of following the law. But I think that we need to get on the other end of this after having an entire generation think that this is a basic right. You know, we've got to get to another mindset that this is bad for women.
Sarin Foster is our guest, and we're basing this interview with her on something that we found on the website for Feminists for Life, feministsforlife.org. It's called Talking Points. The website address, again, is feministsforlife.org. Now, if you have a question or a comment for Sarin Foster, the president of Feminists for Life, call now, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Let's spend the last several minutes talking about something you've alluded to several times during this conversation, Sarin, and that is pursuing this issue, be it in the form of debate or conversation, with the younger generation, not only women but also men. Why is that a fruitful path to pursue?
Well, let me just say that since Feminists for Life's college outreach program started 9 years ago, that we have seen a decrease in abortion, a drop of 30% by women who have graduated from colleges. And this is really important, not only because women who are in college are at highest risk of abortion. One out of five women who have had an abortion are in college. But we have to remember that they also go on and become legislators and teachers, healthcare people, public policy, you know, directors, journalists, et cetera. And so this group is very pivotal to the direction of this debate. And I am so proud to see that, you know, we've been able to participate in this in a dramatic change for the postgraduates, a 30% decrease in abortion, which is astronomical if you think about this in terms of, you know, just a few, 9 years is a short time to see this kind of drop. And we're also able to see a huge increase by the women who are in college. Years ago, we would see 67-68% of women who are in college supporting abortion, and now it's about half and half. So we're making huge inroads, but we've got to remember that when they walk into college and in that environment, that's a really – it's a big challenge for students who are away from their parents, exposed to a lot of things, and they have to set their own boundaries, that when they go there and they find themselves or somebody else they know pregnant and they think that they can't handle it, there's no housing, no daycare, no maternity coverage, that that they need to know that they can look Feminists for Life up, they can go in terms of developing resources on and off campus, but they can also look in their local yellow pages and look for abortion alternatives. And with our college outreach program on campus, we're seeing a dramatic change in the attitudes by young women toward abortion, and those who go to college pro-life are less likely to become pro-choice. This is huge. And I think we all have to celebrate, and that includes the work that you do on the radio and talking to people about this crucial issue, that now 51% of American women oppose abortion. And this is huge. And the Faye Waddleton, who used to run Planned Parenthood, and all the abortion advocates who look at the poll that she just released, the Center for the Advancement of Women, just released a poll. 51% of women now oppose abortion. And this is huge. I mean, the culture is shifting, and all the work that you do. I want to thank you. And we've gotten amazing feedback online by some of your listeners after these shows, and they've found our resources to be helpful. And so I want to thank you for helping to make that change, too.
Well, Saren, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And that is precisely, you know, why we are here on this issue of life, is to put people in touch with solid organizations that can inform and equip them, not only to the point of dialogue and debate, but also for their personal knowledge to buck up and reinforce what it is they already believe. Whether it be the college campus or the water cooler or over the back fence or over the telephone, how do we get past the point of debate on this issue when we're talking to someone who is adamantly pro-choice?
Just remember where they're coming from and just go back to what is the original problem that they're seeing. What is the obstacle that they think that women can't face? And remind them that women are strong and that they can overcome things, especially with support and people who are willing to not just talk about a problem, but put their mind to making real changes for women by listening to women, giving women what they really want and what women really deserve, that we're going to come out of this mess and we're going to look back on this brutal part of our history and wonder how we did anything this barbaric, but we'll put it in its proper place. And when we can speed up the time to the day that abortion is unthinkable by challenging people to say, is this the best we can do for women?
As a feminist, can you foresee a time when what has become the popular support of radical feminists for abortion is merely seen then as kind of a dark chapter in feminist history, where feminism can return to what it was 200 years ago, and this could be viewed as a detour into a very dark alley?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be much of the parallel of when the United States, and we have so much to be proud of in our history, and we look at, you know, some of the things that we've done in terms of slavery or some other things, the way we've treated Native Americans, et cetera. We know that there are dark parts of our history. We also know that America is a bright and shining spot in the world today, and overall our history is very rich and wonderful. It's going to take that kind of perspective, and years later we're going to look back and put abortion in the same context when we talk about feminism and women's rights, and we'll recognize that this was one of the worst possible things that we could have done to a woman.
We were talking recently with Olivia Gantz. She's from the National Right to Life Committee. She has a compelling story to tell on her own about her abortion. And one thing that she said that has just stuck in my mind since this conversation is that she said when she had her abortion, she wasn't pro-choice. She had her abortion because she was desperate.
Mm-hmm.
She had nowhere else to turn. She didn't think her parents would have supported her. Her boyfriend at the time basically went along with the several doctors that they visited who were all trying their darndest to talk her into abortion. And she said, make her feel stupid and ill-equipped if she didn't make this choice of terminating the life of her child. She said she wasn't pro-choice. She was desperate.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a common story for women in America today who have abortions? Do they do it out of conviction for feminism?
No, absolutely not. They and I think Olivia is right, and she knows this firsthand, and she's courageous enough to speak on the subject. And every story I have heard about a woman who's had an abortion, even those who say that they would, if the situation would was going to challenge them today, that they would make the same choice, they all thought it was a horrible experience. It was all about desperation, and it's about women seeing that there can be better ways and better outcomes. And I think what David Reardon is talking about right now, who's co-written the book Forbidden Grief, that he talks about this in terms of poor choices instead of pro-choice.
Saren Foster, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, I really appreciate it. And thank you and all your viewers for their activism and their devoted support to life and to women. And they, too, are continuing the tradition of Susan B. Anthony by refusing to choose.
Saren Foster is president of Feminists for Life based in Washington, D.C. Women do deserve better. They deserve much better. They deserve to be regarded as those who have been given a gift And that gift is unique to women. They have the ability to bring and bear life into this world. It's a sad day for women when, in order to be considered a good woman, a good, faithful feminist, you have to deny that gift. You have to say that that gift is actually a curse that women must bear, and even when they do have children, it's still inconvenient. If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like the phone number and the mailing address for Feminists for Life, or if you'd like to help support Issues Etc., a radio outreach committed to defending life from beginning to end by making a tax-deductible donation, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or you can write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The Germans have a saying, and that saying is, fear is a bad counselor. A woman who is facing a desperate moment where she thinks her parents will not understand or help. She's got a boyfriend or a husband or maybe just some guy she hooked up with who isn't much help either. The doctor she talks to, they seem to think the only logical, the only smart thing to do would be to have an abortion. That woman's got three strikes against her already. Does this woman deserve to have yet another strike dealt to her and her unborn child that will leave her unborn child dead and her wounded, not only physically, but her conscience as well? No. Fear is a lousy counselor. Desperation is a lousy counselor. What women need is to be told that there is another choice. That doing away with your child in a moment of fear and desperation is not the only choice you have, and it's not a good choice. It's a very bad one. The other choices are manifold. To have this child and be its mother all its life long, or to have this child and let someone else be his or her mother. And there are people besides that doctor and your boyfriend, or the guy you just hooked up, or your husband, or your parents who won't support you. There are other people who will, who not only care about the baby and you out of a matter of principle, but care about the baby and you because they care about the baby and you. They want to see the best for you and your child. Fear is a bad counselor. There are other counselors out there besides the fear and the desperation. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.